Today at Reader's Corner, Nicholas Carr, author of The Glass Cage, Automation and Us.
Until recently, when the topic of automation came up, we think that that was something that happened in factories. What we've been seeing recently is that we're handing off more kinds of work, in whole or in part, to computers. Being challenged, being deeply engaged in a hard task, and practicing it over and over again actively is the secret to building talent, to building skills. Unfortunately, software programmers make their programs, their applications and their apps and so forth, to relieve us of effort, to relieve us of active engagement.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The epic battle between man and machine has long been part of our culture, folklore, and philosophy. But best-selling author Nicholas Carr makes the case that increasing automation is raising the stakes in this battle, and he is not all that sure we will remain masters of our creation. In his book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us, Mr. Carr explores how a growing reliance on computers and computer software is rapidly changing the way Americans live, play, work, and learn. For example, many of us launch apps for everything from navigating unfamiliar roads to listening to music. The problem is we don't know when to say enough. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Nicholas Carr. He writes about technology and culture and is the author of several other books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2011. He has written for many publications, including The Guardian in London, The Atlantic, The New York Times, Wired, and Nature. Mr. Carr joins us by phone for this interview. Nicholas Carr, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
I guess the other thing I could have added, Nicholas, is that if people are interested in what else we're reading here at Reader's Corner, we just read a book called The Circle by Dave Eggers. And it's a cautionary tale about what life could look like if big tech companies really ruled the world. Some would argue they already do, of course. But I couldn't help but read it and think of 1984, which, of course, was a satire on what life looked like in a totalitarian regime. Only their government was the problem. In Eggers' book, it's a technology firm that is overly involved in our lives. In a sense, that's the subject of your book as well. One other thing, if I could point out, there's a gentleman by the name of David Talbot. I was sent his article this morning. He wrote it somewhere in San Francisco, and I just briefly read through it. And at one point, he says, "Are you going to create a software tool that lays off an entire industry and replaces human interaction with bots? Or are you going to find ways to save the planet and liberate the human spirit?" You certainly, in your book, have addressed the issue of how computers are changing the way we work and how work is performed. Could we start there, maybe giving us a summary of what our lives and careers look like today in so many different areas, from architecture to accounting to medicine? What's going on here?
Sure. I think until recently, when the topic of automation came up, you know, we think that that was something that happened in factories with automated assembly lines and robots and so forth. What we've been seeing recently is that we're handing off more kinds of work, in fact, almost all kinds of work, in whole or in part, to computers. So what used to be relegated to the world of factories and manufacturing is now moving throughout almost all professions, including, you know, white-collar professionals. And what's happening is that because computers now are able to analyze data, sense the environment, and make judgments, we can start to automate things like medicine and law and architecture, as you said. So for most people today, when they go to work, at least some part of their job has been turned over to software. In some cases, people are losing their job entirely to computers, but in more cases, we're kind of negotiating a division of labor between the human being, the human professional, and the computer or the software program or the robot. And what I argue is we're not doing this in a very humane or humanistic way. we tend to give precedence to what the computer can do and push ourselves into a more passive role. We become people who watch screens for information or enter data into templates or checklists. And so I think we need to step back, what I argue, and think about how do we share jobs, including very sophisticated ones, with computers without losing, without sacrificing our own unique skills, talents, and insights. And it strikes me that that is going to be a question that only grows in importance in the coming years.
And before we get to what you might call the solution, let's talk about the problem and some of the research that you uncovered from the 1970s. Some cognitive psychologists were studying deep cognitive and memory processes, and you come up with a term called the generation effect, which is the way humans, as long as we know, have always reached decisions and worked toward problem solving. But the generation effect with the impact of technology then leads to another effect, the degeneration effect. Help us understand both of those, if you could explain better than I can, certainly, what you mean by this deep cognitive and memory process, and then help us understand how it's degenerated.
So what's called the generation effect was kind of first described, as you say, back in the 1970s, and it originally came out of experiments that looked at how people, particularly young people, students, learn vocabulary, how they learn new words. And what the scientists found is that you learn in a much deeper way if you actually are active in the process of learning. So if you just read a word, you know, a vocabulary word, you're not going to learn it that well. But if you're forced to call that word to mind, and particularly if you're forced to call that word to mind over and over again and actually use it in sentences, you learn it very, very deeply. And since then, it's become clear that the generation effect actually operates in learning of all kinds. So to boil it down, if you're active, if you're actively engaged in a challenge, working through a problem, you're going to learn that skill much better than if you're just reading about how to do something in a book or if you're looking at a computer screen and so forth. So it turns out, you know, that being challenged, being deeply engaged in a hard task and practicing it over and over again actively is the secret to building talent, to building skills. Unfortunately, the way today that software programmers make their programs, their applications and their apps and so forth, they look for ways to relieve us of effort, to relieve us of active engagement. You know, the big trend in software is often described as to remove the friction from work and the friction from lives, and that means to relieve us of the hardest challenges and to relieve us of the need to practice skills over and over again. And so that leads, I argue, to what might be called the degeneration effect. Software steals from us the opportunities to exercise our talents, to learn those talents deeply, and to extend our talents, and instead has this tendency to turn us into passive operators of computers, where we're not enjoying the benefits of the generation effect simply because we've been relieved of the effort necessary to expand our skills and talents and to engage deeply with whatever type of work we're doing.
So my grandson is a sophomore in high school. When he started as a freshman, he was given an iPad. Every student in the freshman class was given an iPad. Good idea or bad idea?
I think simply to do that is not a good idea. And now we're seeing that happen as early as kindergarten and first grade. We're constantly pushing technology, not only at home but through schools, onto students. And the problem isn't that, you know, learning to use a computer is bad. The problem isn't that computers can do some very valuable things in education. The problem is that we're putting too much emphasis on the use of computers to do pretty much everything. And one thing we know about, I think, in particular child development, and this relates to the generation effect, I think, is that it's very important for kids to interact with the world and to interact with knowledge and to interact with one another in all sorts of ways. with their hands, with their minds, with their voices. If we constantly push more and more screen time onto kids, we narrow their horizons because we limit the ways they learn, the ways they interact socially and with the natural world. So this, unfortunately, you know, particularly in America, it seems we have this view when it comes to the problems we face in our educational system, and they're real complex problems. We all too easily see technology, computers, as a panacea. And our assumption is, well, if we could just push more and more computing onto kids and get more computers into their hands, we're going to magically improve the educational outcomes. And there's really no evidence that that's true. Computers have a place in education, but it's also important to realize that, you know, the fundamentals of education are not going to be achieved simply by pushing tablets and computers and smartphones into kids' hands.
You're listening to Nicholas Carr. He's the author of The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. So let's run through some other aspects of our lives and careers where technology plays an important role, and you've done some excellent research. Tell us about the Albany School of Public Health at the State University of New York, where a study was done on the impact of primary care physicians using electronic records.
Yeah, so there's been a big push, particularly over the last 10 years, as anybody who's gone to the doctor probably knows, of shifting from traditional paper records where doctors, after they examine you, will either dictate or write out notes about your visit and then put them into the file. And there's been this big push to shift to digital records. And so often you go in to see the doctor and the doctor has a tablet or a laptop and is entering data during the course of the exam. And, you know, there's all sorts of reasons to be optimistic about that change, because one of the big problems, of course, with paper records is they tend to get isolated in particular doctors' offices, so it's hard for doctors to share them. So the idea was, you know, if we digitize all this and give all the doctors computers, then we'll overcome that problem. But it turns out, when you look at the actual research that's done into what happens when doctors start using computers to record notes and to do diagnoses and stuff, there's lots of unintended effects. And we see actually the problem of exchanging or opening up patient records is not being solved because different hospitals and different practices use different software. And other expectations aren't panning out. We're not seeing a reduction in costs from the use of digital records. In fact, we're seeing, in many cases, an expansion of costs, a raising of costs. But what happens, and this was totally unexpected, is that it influences when you introduce a computer into the doctor-patient relationship, you change that relationship. So doctors feel, and patients say this as well, more distanced from the patient and more reliant on the computer to kind of walk them through how they, not only how they should do an exam, but how they should think. And also, and this is maybe the biggest irony, is that the quality of medical records goes down when doctors begin using computers. And the reason is because what they end up doing is cutting and pasting lots of the verbiage from earlier patient visits or from generic kind of descriptions of diseases and conditions. And so in automating record keeping, we've ended up not getting the benefits we expected, at least so far, but we've ended up reducing the quality of the very thing we automate, which is the patient records. And now, you know, the study you referred to that was done out of Albany found that doctors, particularly primary care physicians, complain that, you know, the richness of information that they used to get from patient records just isn't there anymore. And as one doctor told the researchers, it's turned into boilerplate. So that is one example among many that shows that when you automate a sophisticated job, what often happens is that the unexpected events, the unexpected consequences, turn out to be more important than all the benefits you thought you'd receive.
And how about the effect on architecture and architects?
This was a very interesting area to see how the introduction of computers influences creative work. And it turns out computers do a very, very good job at things that architects used to struggle with and spend a lot of time on that don't involve creativity. For instance, generating construction plans or letting a client kind of see a 3D picture of a building as it's being constructed. Computers are very good at that. But what happens is that often architects begin to sit down at the computer right at the beginning of a project. And that seems to deaden their creative skills and their creative vision. And it turns out that working with a pencil, sketching by hand in a notebook, building physical models out of cardboard, there's been a lot of research into kind of the sources of creativity in architecture. And it turns out that those kind of manual skills are very, very important, particularly in the early stages of figuring out the design of a building. And when you bring a computer in too early, because then you lose that kind of manual, tactile engagement with the work you're trying to do, and suddenly you're moving a mouse around and tapping out things on a keyboard, and you seem to cut off, in a subtle but very real way, some of the sources of the most creative thinking. And so there's been a kind of rebellion against that among many architects who are now, instead of kind of sitting down at a computer at the beginning of a project, are taking out their old sketch pads and building physical models. And then only later, when they've refined their ideas, are they going to the computer to do the kind of more routine things like generating detailed plans and so forth. So I think what that example shows us is that we're very quick to assume that if a computer can do something, we should let the computer do it. And it's only afterwards that we begin to realize that we've dulled or reduced our own skills and talents and creativity. So one of the big challenges here is to figure out, you know, when should I bring the computer into a process and how should I divide what I do compared to what I allow the computer to do. And that's a very complicated but very important decision that I think all of us should be thinking about as we bring computers not only into our work lives but into our personal lives.
How has the accounting profession been impacted by automation or technology they use?
Here too, more and more of the analysis and decision-making done by accountants and business auditors is being done by software. And here too, we see the professional who used to grapple with hard challenges in lots of different circumstances become dependent on the computer to make decisions for him or for her. There was a very interesting study done a few years ago. It was done in Australia, where the researchers, academic researchers, looked at three big accounting firms. And what they discovered was that the more sophisticated the software that auditors and accountants use, the less those accountants learned about what they were doing. So, for instance, the people who used very sophisticated software actually understood business risk less well than the people who were using less sophisticated software. And the reason is, again, because it takes away the generation effect. You become reliant on the computer to do the hard analysis and judgment making, and so you don't exercise your own skills. You don't develop your own know-how and knowledge. And the lesson here is that there's this push by software programmers and by businesses to use the most sophisticated software possible that automates as much of a job as possible. And yet what can happen as a result is that the human beings involved in it lose their own talents, their own insights, and their own skills. And I read one paper that warned that as our financial system becomes more complex, as lots of financial dealing is done by computers, we're actually increasing the risk in our financial system at the very same time that we're reducing the talents and the insights of the people working in that system. And obviously that raises, you know, the potential for the kinds of market meltdowns and market failures that we've seen, unfortunately, in recent years.
Today we're talking about the book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. We're discussing it with its author, Nicholas Carr. Then there's also the role of the autopilot, and you talk in your book about Sully Sullenberger and the way he saved the plane at LaGuardia, but that's really after technology failed, and I guess you're point again is, does autopilot put pilots in this position of not being prepared to use their human skills and competencies, being so over-reliant on technology?
Yeah, and last year, the Federal Aviation Administration released a report that warned that pilots aren't exercising their manual flying skills enough, that they become too dependent on autopilots and other flight automation systems, and as a result, are all too often losing their attentiveness, or what's called situational awareness during a flight, and also their skills are becoming rusty because they're not exercising them enough. And so when something goes wrong, when, for instance, the autopilot or flight automation systems fail or can't handle a particular event, a weather emergency or whatever, the pilot is suddenly required to take over manual flying, and too often they're making mistakes. And I think you see this, unfortunately, in recent records of flights. And so back in 2009 was a very interesting year because that's when the Sully Sullenberger was able to land the jet on the Hudson River and save all the passengers and all the crew, even though both of the engines of the plane had gone out because the plane, if you recall, hit a flock of geese on takeoff. What that shows us is that the pilot is still an essential and will continue to be an essential part of flying a plane. And you need people who have very good skills, very deep experience, like Sullenberger, to handle these emergency situations. And yet what we're doing by making pilots so dependent on the automated systems is that, again, we're stealing from them the opportunity to hone their skills, to really practice those skills, and to stay attentive and engaged in the act of flying. So when something does go wrong, they can seamlessly take over and use their own expertise. And here, too, it shows us how quickly, even in these very dangerous circumstances, we are to hand over all sorts of talents and skills and responsibilities to computers without clearly thinking about what role, what crucial role the human being continues to play and why it's so important to make sure the human skills are up to par and exceptionally good in the case of pilots. So here, too, we're starting to see from the FAA and other places a kind of switch in focus from let the computer do everything to, hey, hold on a minute, let's get the benefits from computer automation, but let's not forget that we human beings bring exceptionally important skills and perspectives to these complex jobs, and we should design the systems to get the most out of the people as well as to get the most out of the computer.
And you talk about human-centered technology. Just what do you mean by human-centered technology?
Up until now, what kind of dominates the design of software, the design of automated systems, is something that experts in this area call technology-centered automation. And that means that the programmer or the engineer will start by saying, well, what can the machine do? What can the computer do? And then every task that is possible to shift over to the computer, it all gets shifted to the computer. And what happens then is, and we've been talking about, you know, a number of examples already, the human being, the professional, the expert, becomes passive and becomes a computer operator and isn't exercising and expanding their skills. There's a very different approach that unfortunately is rarely taken. That's called human-centered automation. And that means the programmer or the engineer, the designer, starts by saying, what are people good at? And it turns out we're better than computers at all sorts of important things. We sometimes don't give ourselves credit, but conceptual thinking, critical thinking, creative thinking, ingenuity, experience, all of these qualities of thought are things that we have and we're very good at and computers are very bad at. And so with human-centered automation, you design the system to make sure that the human being is actively involved in the job, is exercising their talents, exercising their ingenuity, and the computer becomes, in effect, an aid to the human being, doing what computers are good at, giving us more information than we could ever, you know, contain in our own mind, challenging our biases, alerting us to errors we might be making. But this kind of striking the right balance between keeping the human being deeply engaged in the work while also delivering the benefits of the computer, rather than simply saying, let the computer do everything the computer can do, and whatever's left over, we'll hand that off to the human being.
Seems like there's another angle here. And again, we haven't touched on all the careers and all the jobs that are affected by technology. I've just chosen a few that I thought would be most interesting to our listeners. But there's absolutely no doubt in my mind anyway that the other side of this coin, and this may be your next book, Nicholas, is each one of these careers and professionals and folks doing to improve the skills and the competencies, human skills and competencies of the practitioners? What role does continuing education play in this? I think you touched on one of these careers where they're actually going back and thinking through this issue. But it just seems to me like I'm left with, boy, more than ever before, we absolutely have to get the attention of these associations, from the American Bar Association to whatever the National Association is for Accountants and the AMA and everybody else, to start implementing continuing education that may look a little different than it did in the past. And I wonder if you have any thoughts or experience or knowledge on whether anybody's out there doing this.
Well, there's not enough of that going on. I mean, just as there is not enough, you know, focus on the human in designing the systems, I don't think there's enough focus on skill building in general as people move through their careers and are required to share jobs with computers, because that means when the systems are well designed, that can actually give greater responsibility to the human being. It can the best automated systems, the best machines, relieve us of kind of drudge work or relieve us of skills we've already mastered, so we can focus on extending our skills even further. And if you can design the systems to do that, then ongoing education and ongoing training becomes absolutely essential to that expansion of skills or shift in focus of skills and talents. So, you know, I think this is a multifaceted problem that is going to require a multifaceted solution that combines, you know, smart software design and system design with smart educational programs and with companies that look beyond immediate efficiency gains to the longer-term benefits of having a deeply skilled professional workforce in place that is able to constantly push business processes forward, rather than taking a robotic approach that just optimizes what you're already doing but doesn't give you the human insight and ingenuity required to constantly improve the quality of your work, the efficiency of your work. So it's going to, in being so quick to kind of give precedence to the interests of the computer, so to speak, we've created this deep problem moving forward that I think is going to have to be addressed from a lot of different angles. There's no, you know, simple silver bullet solution.
Well, Nicholas, as usual, we haven't been able to cover everything that you've managed to cram into this book. It's a great read. It's The Glass Cage, Automation and Us by Nicholas Carr. Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Nicholas Carr. Next week, Lawrence Goldstone, author of Birdmen, The Wright Brothers, Glenn Curtis, and The Battle to Control the Skies. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Ralph Poor. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To listen to recent interviews anytime, download our free player from the iTunes App Store. Find it by searching for Reader's Corner.